Well, folks, we're going to shift gears now, and we're just going to go through a lot of questions. So it's Ask Us Anything time. So if you would like to ask us anything, ask us now. Wrap your question in a donation, either DLive tokens or cash money over at Entropy, and we will run through it, and we're going to give you our best takes on these things. So I want to go back to Jasper. He says, my five-year-old daughter is beginning to ask questions about our identity. She recently told me Indians were in America first. She must have heard it in school. I told her that was true, but Europeans, our ancestors, settled and developed the land to create all the wonderful things we have now. How would you talk to a child about white identity? Well, you being a Canadian, of course, you've got all your woeful stories of the First Nations. They were here first.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of ways to talk about this. And okay, you've asked two questions. I mean, you gave the example of the Indians in your response, which is a perfectly good response. And then a general question, how do we talk to children about white identity? Okay, I want to deal with both of those, and I hope in Endeavor we'll deal with both of them too. The response to the Indian question is basically this. My paternal ancestors set foot in America in 1618, I think it was. It was the year before the black people came, 1618, yeah. I want to have a 1618 project celebrating me and my... and my family. My family in Jamestown survived, my ancestors in Jamestown survived two Indian massacres. Okay. I wouldn't be here if they hadn't survived those massacres. And the Indians tried to kill every last colonist. Anybody in North America who descends even partially from old stock settlers, chances are, descends from the survivor of an Indian massacre. So I just don't care. Yeah, when you know that, suddenly all those violins and mournful flutes and Indian sounds that they make, they don't pluck at my heartstrings. It was war. It wasn't always war. And oftentimes when there was war, it was because Indians would pretend to be friends, and then they would launch a massacre, a sneak attack. They usually launched sneak attacks, and they didn't spare women and children, and they were incredibly cruel people. And I just don't feel that impressed with them. I don't feel that impressed with them because I know who I am. I'm a survivor of Indian massacres. I'm a survivor, right? I think that's important. I don't know, Jasper, how your family tree works, but if your family was in the New World going back to the 17th century, chances are you're a survivor. You're an 8th generation or 10th generation Indian massacre survivor. And I think that we should respect our ancestors. We should respect our ancestors, and we should be glad that they survived. And we should not be susceptible to the kind of emotional manipulation that we get with this story about, oh, they were here first. Yeah, they were here first. They weren't everywhere here first. Oftentimes they were here before us after exterminating another tribe of Indians that were there before them. And on and on. It's very morally complicated. It's not the simple game, the simple moralistic story that they were here first and we took it away from them. Oftentimes they sold it and then they'd try and kill us once they got our wampum. You know, they were not innocent victims here. Oftentimes they were very, very foolish and venal people who gave away their future, very much like white people are giving it away today, because white people made it worth their while. That's how I would respond in the Indian thing. And as for how to talk to children about white identity, I'll just say this. As a parent, you have power. Every study that I've seen about how to form the forces that shape the values and outlook of a child show that parents are the greatest influence. Now, we have all these voices, usually leftist voices, speaking with forked tongues in the media and education system, saying, don't try and teach your values to your children. They'll just rebel against you. Of course, when they try and brainwash your kids about the Indians, they don't think, there's no point in brainwashing them about global warming or the Indians. They'll just rebel against us. They don't believe that shit. They're telling you that so they can have your kids delivered to their brainwashing centers as blank slates. Don't do it. What you say around your kids matters more than anybody else if you don't cede that power to the cultural establishment, and don't do that. And the thing that impresses children most is not arguments. By giving her an argument about how we settled the land and everything and developed it, I think she's 5 years old. That's more complicated than a five-year-old can really grasp. Just praise and blame things when they're 5 years old. Basically teach them to see the beauty of the things that our people have done and the ugliness of the things that their people have done, or the inadequacy of the things that their people have done. Praise and blame, don't argue, don't apologize, just be masterful and self-confident, and they will pick up your values. That's how it works. So anyway, Endeavor, what are your thoughts on this? How do we teach our kids to resist this anti-white propaganda, which they're getting at five and earlier?
Well, it's a little difficult for me to say because I don't have children yet myself. What I would say to someone is, I definitely agree that you have to teach them your values, because the trick that saying, well, don't teach your kids this, that because then they'll rebel against that. I totally agree. That's complete rubbish. If that was the truth, then they'd be teaching white identity in the schools. So then all the kids would turn out to be shit libs, but no, yeah. They don't do that though. But what I'd say is, don't make it like a constant, like evangelism, and don't kind of like, don't try to like red pill them on like, like race realism or the JQ or stuff, because kids won't understand that. I'd say just like give them an idea that so if you're in North America, for example, and when they say when they come home with things like for that about the Indians and stuff, say that we're from Europe and try to get it in their mind that we're a unique people of our own, and give them some positive things about it. So maybe if you have a son, tell him a story about the Mayflower or something like that, or tell him a story about Captain James Cook. I named my channel after the HMS Endeavor because I just thought the story was cool. I guess just give them kind of a positive understanding of themselves in that way, and give them an understanding that they are unique as a people. And I think that's kind of the best. That's probably all you need to do on the race issue with children. And then, I guess also countering the propaganda by just telling them like there's nothing wrong with them and they have nothing to apologize for, and that they're special in their own way. I know that kind of sounds like a cheesy cliche that you'd tell your young child, but I guess just reassure them that there's nothing wrong with them, and I guess give them the idea that they're a unique people of their own. Maybe introduce them to some things. Some European settlers or something like that, or something that they can think of that's cool about them. And I think that's probably all you need to do.
Yeah, I think you're right. Horatio Nelson gives $25. Conservative MP David Amos was murdered on Friday in Essex by a 25-year-old Somali. Amos, or I hope it's Amos or maybe it's Ames, was a big supporter of BLM and Every Refugee Matters, which shows that just because you virtue signal doesn't mean they eat you last. The question is not, is it Islamic terrorism, but rather, why are there Somalis in England? It's a good point. I always say that when people start shaking their heads and saying, what are the root causes of this? I always say, well, you know, it never would have happened if there were no Somalis in England. It's really as simple as that. If white people had a country of our own in England, this would not have happened.
Yeah, you live by the Somali, you die by the Somali.
Yeah, yeah. And your virtue signaling will not save you. It's really, really true. Okay, Reed Johnson writes in, I know that's a pen name, Reed writes in with $10. Everyone knows Clive Owen is the greatest James Bond that ever was. I don't know why I didn't see this earlier. He supposedly wanted more money. Is it better to be James Bond at any price or to be the guy cool enough to turn down James Bond? What's the importance of knowing one's own value? Yeah, that's an interesting question, yeah. I didn't know that Clive Owens was the Bond, a Bond that never was. So Unknown Californian writes in with $20. That's very generous. Thank you. History has shown that when a people are victorious, they often burn and destroy the remnants of the vanquished, such as the Library of Alexandria or the Mayan and Aztec cultural items. When we regain power and Greg becomes a grand chancellor, will we destroy the poisonous cultural Zog influences such as movies, music, books? Or do you think that any of these things are worth preserving and can no longer be a threat to future generations? Okay, I'm really very much opposed to destroying culture. One of the things that affected me profoundly early on when I was a kid is I read a lot. I was a nerd. And I liked reading about history and I liked reading about art. And I was fascinated by the art of the ancient world, the art of the Aztecs and the Mayans and the Peruvians, the Inca. I was impressed by this. And I was hurt when I discovered that we don't know much about their spiritual culture because, well, it was destroyed. I don't like that. The vast majority of plays by Sophocles have been lost. The vast majority of classical Greek and Roman literature simply doesn't exist anymore. That's a terrible thing. And we have to prevent that from happening to our civilization. Now, what would we do with all the poisonous junk culture? Well, first of all, it's not all junk. And I think it should be kept. I don't think it should be destroyed. I think that people should be given better stuff to read and look at and so forth, better music, better messages. But the bad stuff, I think, needs to be kept around. Some of it's good. It's just tainted. But some of it's, even if it's just really bad and awful, we need to keep a record of this. But we need to inoculate people against taking it seriously. We need to educate people's tastes and educate people's understanding of propaganda so that when they see this stuff, they're not taken in by it. Because what if you say, okay, we're just going to destroy all this rubbish, you know, we're going to just take all the feminist books out and burn them, right? Well, one or two of them might survive and, you know, times will change, regimes will change, cultural climates will change, and suddenly this stuff might resurface and people won't be prepared for it. They might fall for this bullshit again. So it's better to just keep it around, you know, keep it on the library shelves where they get dusted occasionally, but people have better stuff to occupy their minds with. And they're educated in such a way, their tastes and their ideology are educated in such a way that if they stumble across this stuff, they're not going to be fooled again. I mean, that's how I would handle it. What are your thoughts on this endeavor?
I guess what I would do is, and now, you know, I mean, this is assuming that we actually are able to take over control of our countries again. And that doesn't, and that's without them, the countries, you know, falling apart first, which I'm not too optimistic on. I'm not saying I'm completely black-pilled, but I do think there'll be a lot of upheaval before, you know, anything positive comes in. And, you know, who knows what, will things get lost? Will certain works of culture be destroyed just because for the same reason that things like a lot of old films are just lost because they lost the reels for them. I think that might happen to a lot of, I think that's going to, that might actually happen to a lot of a lot of them. But and who knows, maybe like with all the affirmative action stuff, will there be people who are just not high IQ enough to save them or something? I don't know. But like it just theoretically, you know, what I'd probably do is I'd probably use it in the same way that the left uses something like Birth of a Nation or Triumph of the Will Today. I'd probably use it in that same way of like showing them like this is why we can never embrace these ideas ever again. That's why, you know, we can never take, you know, things like our own, we can never take our own race for granted ever again. We can never take our own control over our lands as for granted ever again. Basically, I'd keep that as a reminder for people, but I would, you know, use it in a certain way to essentially as propaganda, like as reverse propaganda, I guess, the same way that the left uses certain things from the early 20th century today. I'd say, I don't know if I also will agree that not all of it is junk. So not every, you know, movie that has some like diversity in it is junk. There's plenty of good films. And, you know, even in some ways they might actually just be a representation of this era or maybe the past era. Mm-hmm. They will be a representation of, you know, the 2000s or the 1990s or something like that. I wouldn't want to destroy that in order to like kind of rewrite the past in order to forget about what happened. I think that we kind of do have to live with, we do have to live with the last, you know, 70 years or so, or however long you want to put it back. I don't think we can reset the clock to 1945 or 1900 or anything like that. We do kind of have to live with the lessons that we've taken on, that we've learned over the last several decades, and whatever, you know, comes out, whatever positive thing we're able to create in the future. We need to have those reminders. So I'd probably keep some of them around for that purpose.
Yeah. Sort of memento moris, right?
Yeah.
We need some new entropy and DLive donations and questions, folks. And while you are scrambling to do that, I'm going to go back to something from last weekend where Gadius wrote in with 30 US bucks. Thank you. He says, a Charlottesville case is set to begin near the end of the month. Some of these cases include folks that I'm not fond of, yet I think it's important that they win because in the end, it's a fight against a common enemy. What do you gentlemen think about the concept of bearing the hatchet in general for the greater cause? Okay, this I think is a good question, which is why I'm going back a whole week or almost a week to read it. There are two other questions or comments that I want to bring in, and then I want to give you a few thoughts on this. A few weeks ago, we published a thing about the drama, basically, in Nick Fuentes's America First movement. And we've published a couple of things after that about this topic. And a fellow who's a very good guy and been very helpful to me in the past wrote in and said, I was not happy to see this criticism of Fuentes. Shouldn't we all hang together lest we hang separately? And then I have another conversation with a friend who wanted to help Jason Kessler, who's one of the Charlottesville defendants, but he was really worried that if he helped Jason Kessler, because a lot of these people are sharing lawyers, that could somehow help people that he just thinks are despicable, who are also Charlottesville defendants. So I want to answer all three of these concerns right now, and I want to get Endeavor's thoughts on this. Okay. All of these have to do with the issue of solidarity. How much solidarity should we have with people in our cause, generally, broadly in our cause, and what conditions should be put on that? So to say we can't criticize Nick Fuentes because we should all stick together and against our common enemies, I don't think that follows. I think that nobody should be above criticism within our ranks in terms of their ideas or their optics or their character. Why? Well, because criticism is how we grow. And what we're doing is so important. Our cause is so just. Our enemies are so powerful we're so few and the time is so short that we just can't afford to mess it up. And that means that we can't create an atmosphere where bad characters and bad ideas and bad optics flourish without criticizing them on the assumption that we should all stick together. I don't think that's good. I think that sort of solidarity creates what's called a moral hazard. A moral hazard is a concept from business and insurance. Basically, a moral hazard is when you create a conditions where wrongdoing has fewer consequences, and therefore you encourage more wrongdoing. For instance, when you bail out the banks for speculative, risky behavior, you create more speculative, risky behavior. That's called creating a moral hazard. Well, if we automatically shut down criticism of people within our own ranks out of solidarity, that's creating a moral hazard where bad behavior will flourish because it's not criticized, it's not punished, it's not called out. And we can't do that. However, I do think that in the case of something like the Charlottesville lawsuit, that we have to recognize that the people who are being attacked at Charlottesville are not being attacked because of things that you and I might disagree with. They're not being attacked for their bad ideas or their bad optics or whatever. They're being attacked for the fact that they were racially conscious white people who took a stand in public against the erasure of white history and white people. That's why they're being attacked. Not because they had bad haircuts. They're being attacked for the good things that they're doing, not the bad things that they're doing. They're being attacked for the things that we agree with, not the things that we disagree with. And that means, I think, that we should have solidarity with them. At the very least, we owe them moral support. And as for the question about, well, if you help one, aren't we running the risk of helping bad people in the law? I think the greater concern is that we, by resisting this kind of sleazy legal persecution, which is going on in Charlottesville, we're resisting the enemies of all of us. So I think a far more important question is how we resist the enemies of our cause, who are attacking people for the good things that they did, not the bad things. It creates a moral hazard not to stand up against that kind of persecution. These people did nothing wrong in the sense that they did nothing illegal. They did nothing immoral. They were within their constitutional rights, and they were standing up for white interests and white identity and white history. Those are good things. They did nothing wrong, and they're being attacked for the good things, not the bad things that they did. And to not defend them because we have some quibbles about individuals in their ranks is creating a moral hazard. It's making it less likely that white people will stand up in the future. And it's making it more likely that the ones who do are going to be attacked with this kind of lawfare. So anyway, those are my thoughts on this particular issue. Endeavor, what are your thoughts on this?
So what I'll say is that, I haven't kept up on the Charlottesville lawsuits I watched some of Nick Fuentes's clips, but I don't keep up on, the stuff that's going on within his movement. I'm really kind of just a video content creator. What I will say is that, in terms of burying the hatchet with somebody, I don't think you should keep a grudge against someone. I think that's kind of just petty, but at the same time, you also need to remember, if this person failed in a certain way, they probably shouldn't be allowed back in a position of leadership. I think that, having the bad millennial woes talks about this a lot, is that kind of the bad personalities in our movement have really cost us a lot. And in that case, you don't owe it to someone to you don't owe it to somebody who's a psychopath just, to for the sake of solidarity that you forgive them and you let them hang around if they're detrimental. You don't owe anyone that, I don't think, if they're detrimental to the cause. What I will say, like on the guys in Charlottesville, like, I mean, of course I stand in support of them, but I don't really know what I can really do other than just give them verbal support. You know, I don't have any personal animosity towards any of them. There might be some, might have been some people who I disagreed with tactically, but at the same time, I wouldn't, you know, we have a lot more things to worry about than our own egos. In terms of criticizing other people in the movement, I think that we have to, nobody can be above criticism, because then you kind of become like a cult. Then, you know, actual problems never get addressed. But what I will say is, if you're going to do this, and you're a figurehead or something like that, or maybe it's not even like online, maybe it's in your community or something like that, you can do it without creating internet drama. So don't do a live stream about it. Don't do a huge stream talking about how this person is a bad person, and you know, you hate them, and they're all this having all this like dirt on them. What I'd say is, message them, discuss it with them behind closed doors. You don't need to make a big fiasco out of it. And I think that's kind of the best way to go about it. It's you know, you can criticize people, but don't go down the internet drama route, because it's cost us a lot in the past, and it just doesn't really help.
Yeah, the only problem is that some people really are not approachable in that kind of quiet behind the scenes way. They're cocooned inside a little world full of gatekeepers and sycophants, and you're not going to get their attention. So I think that frustrates a lot of people who then go public. However, there are good ways and bad ways of doing it publicly. And if you want to criticize somebody for bad ideas and bad optics or bad manners, at least offer better ideas, better optics, and do it with good manners. There are ways of criticizing people without making it excessively personal, so that they don't get their backs up and resist you.
What I'd like to say is that, like, criticizing someone's ideas is a bit different. Like, yeah, you can criticize someone's ideas. You know, I make a video, someone disagrees with me, they can make a video in response to me, and you know, we can be civil about it. We can, you know, have this kind of discussion and iron out these ideas. I think the question is more about like behavior and things like that, whole managerial aspect, which I'm really not that involved in, but I think you know, you can disagree on ideas. It's more like the internet drama stuff, like this person's a fed, this person's a bad person, this person's talking with this one. I think that stuff that really shouldn't be people shouldn't make a career out of it, because some people have, and it hasn't been very helpful for us.
Yeah, it all gets very tiresome. There's no question about it. Philosophers donated one diamond and another diamond and a Ninjagini. Thank you very much. It's very generous of you. Over at Entropy, we have gotten a couple of donations from Archie and also another one from Unknown Californian. Unknown Californian gives $20. And basically his question is, he sees satanic imagery, the pentagrams and Baphomets and things like that, on backpacks and so forth, and he's just wondering what our thoughts are on that. He says, on the one hand, I understand the rebellious nature of it, similar to the Gadsden or Confederate flag. Well I honestly don't. I guess I'm thinking of like heavy metal albums and stuff like that. Yeah, there's a lot of that kind of stuff within the world of heavy metal, and I think a lot of it is just, It's almost like a swastika or a Gadsden flag or a Confederate flag. It's just a symbol of rebellion. The trouble is that sometimes people will unravel that and get really into it. And a lot of that stuff is really cringe. My attitude about how to deal with it, if your kids are doing it, is just try and teach them better taste. Don't get all evangelical about it. Don't rant and rave about it. Just say, yeah, this is kind of tacky, and then show them something better. That's the best way of dealing with this stuff. Because if you do make too big an issue of it, well, sometimes their backs will get up about it and they will rebel. It's better to always just offer them something cooler than this kind of stuff. So what are your thoughts on this?
On the use of satanic imagery?
Yeah. In popular culture, I guess.
I guess what I would say to that is it's just like it's fake rebellion, really. I mean, like, is this really going to outrage the transsexuals at Google or something like that? No, it's going to be, people who are coming out and questioning the injections that they want to stick inside you or else you can't go to your job. Or there are people who are questioning who aren't kneeling down to black people. That's who they're going to freak out about. The wider culture. So it just seems like so desperate to me, really. I mean, even in the 80s, like maybe back then it could have been seen as somewhat rebellious, but today it's like, come on, who do you think you're kidding? I mean, we have like transsexuals in libraries reading to children. Are you really that edgy having a satanic star on your backpack? Like, come on.
Yeah. It's the idea that sticking it to Christianity, organized Christianity, is like sticking it to the establishment.
I love Stone Toss, by the way. Stone Toss made a great comic about that.
Which one?
It was the one where that there was like the atheist who he put like the cross in urine. And he's like, oh, I'm so edgy. But then I think like, I can't remember exactly what it was. I think like, then somebody threw the what's it called? Menorah in, and then the atheists start sweating.
Oh, years ago, I was suggesting doing just that. So that's kind of cool. Just to illustrate this very, very point that, a menorah in a jar of urine would not be lionized by our cultural organs. That's good. I like that. I like that a lot. Stone Toss is generally really quite good. Archie writes in with $5. I told a New Zealand liberal friend about some Boer colonization and land unsettled by Africans, and he said, BS. He has the same visceral reaction to the idea of race and IQ. He's poisoned with self-hatred. They are non-convertible and try to educate me. Well, I've been there. I've seen that. But it's worth a try. It really is worth a try. The facts are on our side. Most of South Africa was empty. I think all of South Africa was empty of Negroes. There were Kosian people, Bushman people there in places. But the blacks came to South Africa after the Boers came to South Africa. And a lot of them came there because they wanted stuff from the Boers. They were migrating from the north. The Zulus were. There were wars and other reasons for doing that. But a lot of blacks were attracted by the stuff that the Boers created there. So yeah, a lot of what people believe about South Africa is the true BS. In New Zealand, they get all the same rubbish that we get in North America, but it's about the Maori. And I just wish some of my friends in New Zealand would just say, I'm sorry, I'm just not that impressed with these Stone Age people. They're just not that impressive. We should stop bowing down and worshiping them and humoring these Stone Age people. But, I'd like to say it to them, but we have so much of this problem in North America that we haven't made a dent in.
Well, in terms of like replying to the libtards who are just like overdosed on Black Lives Matter or whatever, a lot of them, I really think people just need to, you just need to cut them out of your life, because a lot of them, like I made a video about this recently in terms of this whole vaccine business, how, it's entering the discourse now that somebody who doesn't take their vaccination should be denied entry to the ICU if they break their arm while driving their car or something like that. Like, these people will sign your own death warrant if it lands, if they had the desk at, I don't know, the social justice version of the NKVD or something like that. These people are dangerous, and you know, you really just got to disconnect from them because, you can see, I think like last year in the summer, you can see just how quickly the system is able to whip up people into these violent rages, and you don't want to be in the middle of that. So, you know, with a lot of people like that, you just kind of got to walk away from them. I think I'm not saying that you should do that always, because I do think there's a lot of people who are reasonable and you can get through to them with some work. But if it's one of these people who there's just no chance in hell that you're going to get through to them, then just move on to the next one.
Yeah. Yeah. The left today, they're hysterical and they're incredibly vindictive people. The mask of sanity is gone for a lot of these people. And the other thing that's really interesting about them is they're so bent on creating a new caste system. They're so bent on creating a new caste system where they're the models of propriety, and especially white people who don't go along with them are just moral lepers. Of course, the fact that blacks, who are sacred holy beasts, according to these people, are the most vaccine resistant is something that they simply have to ignore because it doesn't fit in with their worldview. But they're perfectly comfortable with ignoring reality. That's how they became shit libs in the first place. So Archie has written in again with another $5. Thank you. He's got two more comments here. Friends I grew up with seem to have been indoctrinated with white hatred over the decades, and I suspect it's from raising and learning from their children. One is Eighth Meti, and he has grown up to hate Brits too. And he adds with another donation, I was in grade school when my father tried teaching me about our ancestors, but it was too late because Canadian school already instilled that my ethnic tribalism is bad. I rejected listening to my father's stories because they included old ethnic hate. Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, half my family's Canadian, by the way. And I can relate to that because I was hearing about it. My Canadian family were ultra Anglo-Canadian. They were complaining about multiculturalism in Canada far earlier than I heard any whiff of it in the United States. The replacement of the red ensign, the flag of Canada, with the maple leaf, that happened, I think, in the 1960s. And the reason why 1965, the reason why that was done was to obliterate the ethnic origins of the Canadian people from the flag and replace it with something that my family called the logo, the corporate logo. The maple leaf is a corporate logo that has nothing to do with the ethnic makeup of the people who settled Canada.
Oh yeah, so, absolutely.
Yeah. In 1965, they were trying to obliterate their ethnicity. And then I think they were the first nation in the world to make multiculturalism official policy. I think that was around 1970.
It was Justin Trudeau's father was the flag was changed by Lester B. Pearson. He was, you know, the precursor to Trudeau Sr. But Trudeau Sr. was the real one who brought in a bunch of this stuff. But, you know, it is really incredible, I must say, like how quickly Canadians have been written out of their own history. I mean, the flag is like, that's huge. I mean, a lot of times people don't even know that the old flag ever existed. You know, the thing that's so important about the red ensign flag is that it has the Union Jack on it. It has the ethnic ancestry of the people that built the country ingrained into the flag. That's why, you know, it's so significant. And that was, you know, very quickly erased. It's really quite incredible how today a lot of people, they don't know, they couldn't tell you the first thing about Canada's history before the last couple of years. And other than, you know, we were mean to the natives and we apparently had that, like these concentration camp schools where the nuns, I don't know, killed them by firing squad or something like that. I mean, that's what I'm sure they're teaching that in the public schools today.
I'm sure they steamed them like lobsters and things like that. Yeah. It's crazy. I remember when I was a kid, and I was in Canada visiting one of my aunts and my mother, and they were both reading the newspaper, and I was sitting on the floor playing, just very small. And my mother looked over her newspaper and to my aunt Elaine, said, "Elaine, what do you think about Pierre Trudeau being buried at such and such place? Apparently there was some, he announced that he wanted to be buried at such and such place." And my aunt looked over her glasses and said, "The sooner the better." And that was the kind of attitude they had towards the Trudeaus. I'm sure Justin Trudeau would, they probably are spinning in their graves over Justin Trudeau. Some of my my Canadian family. my God,
my ancestors moved to Canada in the 1880s, I believe. About, I think I haven't done the DNA test. I'm about like 90% ethnically Scottish. Though I actually did have one grandfather that was part Métis, but I'm not going to be going around claiming to be a native indigenous Canadian. I mean, I'm sure it's probably like less than 5%. I don't even know. But and like you were saying earlier about like the them going through the struggles. I mean, my great grandfather died when he was 37. He was a poor farmer in Saskatchewan. He had 11 children. My grandmother was his oldest child, and she had to like help her mother raise all these children during the Great Depression. And, you know, like when somebody, you know, talks about like, oh, well, stolen land and stuff like that. And, you know, with all these like loud mouths, none of them went through any of that. They came to Canada. You know, of course, the Indians were there before, but like all the immigrants pouring in today, they came because it was built by our people. So like the idea that you'd feel guilty over that is, it's just preposterous, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. ABC writes in with $5. Are wokeness and political correctness a form of global secular religion? Is there a causal relation between the rise of feminism and JP and the fall of the West in late 20th century? Is this an inside job? Who are the facilitators? Well, I don't know what JP means.
I think it's Jewish power.
Probably. Well, yeah, I mean, it is kind of a secular religion. So yeah, I would say that it has all the sort of psychological and moral characteristics of a religion, and it's a religion of the elect and the damned too. These people are hopped up on self-righteousness. They despise other people. That's part of the payoff. They claim to be egalitarians and love everybody, but they're filled with hatred and they're constantly trying to lord it over other people and feel superior to other people. And I think just calling them on that about a million times is a good thing. There's never any shortage of opportunity to do that. The left today are just increasingly openly nasty, arrogant bastards. And the COVID stuff has really unleashed this arrogance and this just venom, this fake moralism and so forth. Is there a causal relationship between feminism and Jewish power? Yes and no. I mean, feminism was a thing in the middle of the 19th century. Read Henry James's novel, The Bostonians. This was long before huge numbers of Jews poured into the New World starting in the 1890s and became very powerful. And then, of course, they began steering it in their own direction for their own aims. But feminism is a much earlier phenomenon than that, just like, rights for Black people and stuff like that, abolitionism and all that kind of stuff was an earlier thing. It was our thing. It's an indigenous thing to white people. Is it an inside job? Who are the facilitators? Well, I'm not quite sure. Inside job. It's outsiders who are now the insiders who are doing the job, basically. But you know, a lot of the the templates and the ideas, the intellectual movements and so forth that the current establishment is using basically to gaslight us and destroy us were things that were indigenous to European culture. There's a piece by Kevin MacDonald called Indigenous Cultures of Critique that I think you can find that at the Occidental Observer or the Occidental Quarterly. I might have reprinted it at Countercurrents. It's just about the 19th century Protestant Puritan precursors of a lot of the 20th century mostly Jewish intellectual movements that are so dominant today. Endeavor, do you have some thoughts on this?
Yeah, it's a question you could do an entire stream on.
Absolutely.
So, there's the question, would feminism still be a thing if Jewish power wasn't in place in the West? Is that...
I think that's part of it, definitely, yeah.
And the other part was that is wokeism a religion? Well, I'd say on the question of feminism, I do wonder about that, you know, because even in the late 19th century, like you pointed out, things were secularizing. Feminism was becoming was being talked about even before they arrived in North America, and likewise, I find that with the advances of technology, it kind of just made men weaker, and masculine men weren't like required to do a lot of the heavy lifting anymore. You know, eventually women didn't have to, you know, stay home and look after, you know, all these children because they had a new technology and stuff like that. So would feminism have never happened? I don't know. It's hard to say. I do think that the advances of technology definitely made it a lot more plausible, even without the Jewish aspect. However, if you go on Wikipedia and just type in Jewish feminists, you'll get over like 300 different results. They certainly were a huge contributor. I think that if it weren't for that, would we still have feminism today? I think we probably would, but it would be, it's obviously not like a good thing, whether it's from them or from us, an indigenous thing of our culture, but I don't think it would be as nasty as it is. Like, for example, I don't think you'd have like the intersectional feminism where, you know, they feminist just means someone who also hates the white race as well, and they hate our culture and want to import a bunch of refugees. You probably wouldn't have that aspect of feminism, but you might still have some of the illnesses, because you even see in other countries like Japan or South Korea. I mean, it's the women aren't like as nasty as they are in the West, but they still do have a lot of the same social issues from feminism, though. I will have to put an asterisk on the point of Japan. There is I posted on my Telegram a couple months back of a certain Jewish feminist who helped bring women's equality into Japan, and then you see like the graph right after they implemented this new constitution, the birth rates just plummet. So, you know, it's a question that's really hard to answer. You could do an entire stream on that. And then in terms of, is wokeism a religion? I think that it has a lot of the same aspects of a religion. Would you consider the COVID religion and wokeism different? I mean, all the people seem to be the same adherents to the same religion, but they do kind of seem to be somewhat distinct from each other in terms of like what their end goals are. They're all coming from the same source. I would say that the one thing that really differs it from other religions, because they have the zealots, they have the different sins, they have the saints and these rituals, you know, the vaccine has now become their baptism. The difference is that I feel like these pseudo religions kind of have been, they haven't been created out of any pursuit of anything true or good. They've been these have been religions that have been created with a political goal in mind, and that the various tenets of the religion have been crafted in order to bring that about. So like, you know, what is racist? Well, racist is just anything that's not anti-white, because the goal of anti-racism is eventually to destroy European civilization. So I'd say they're an evil religion because they weren't actually brought about. They weren't brought about in any kind of like pursuit of something of goodness and of truth, but really just to give certain people power, really.
Yeah, absolutely. That I think is that is good. So let me just see here. We've got a few more questions. All right. First of all, I want to thank Gadius. He sent us a few more DLive tokens, 7 ice cream. Thank you very much. And I would like to go to a couple questions that I got earlier. Let me just find them here. Okay, Michael. Michael has written in, and he wants to know who my favorite English film directors are. And since you're a film buff, I thought you would like this one too. So my favorite English film directors are David Lean, Alfred Hitchcock, and Michael Powell. Lean for, well, he did 16 movies and most of them are classics, but he did a couple of the greatest movies ever. Certainly, I think Lawrence of Arabia is one of the greatest movies ever. His Dickens movies are fantastic. His early movies with Noel Coward scripts are some of those are quite classic. Hobson's Choice is a classic. So he's one of the great, maybe the greatest English director in my book. I love Hitchcock. He was an Englishman. His best films are fantastic. And I like Michael Powell, really only for a couple of films, but they're such good films. One is The Red Shoes. Another is Black Narcissus. He was just a genius. What are your favorite English directors?
Definitely David Lean as well. I'd say that Lawrence of Arabia and Dr. Zhivago are in my top 5 films ever. You know, A Bridge on the River Kwai might be in like my top 20. So yeah, he's definitely my number one. I also like Christopher Nolan. He's a great director, probably one of the best directors alive today.
I agree with that. Yeah,
you can't go wrong with Hitchcock either.
Yeah. Excellent. Excellent. And I had a question from Sutton wrote in, this is just a pop culture question, but we're running out of time and it's a short one. ABBA is reuniting after nearly 40 years with a new album. Are you excited? Well, yes, I have to admit that is a very exciting thing. They quit around 1981. So yeah, it's about 40 years. In the 80s, they were so uncool. And since then, they have become cool again. I always liked ABBA. I've never hidden that fact. Even when I was into, you know, goth music and stuff like that, and was something of a poser, I never pretended that I didn't like ABBA or bands like Boston and stuff like that. That was so uncool. So anyway, I think it's very excited, and I watched the video that they put out of this song, I Still Have Faith in You. And I was just bowled over by what a beautiful song it is. It's one of their best songs. It's just lovely. So take a listen to that. And I think you'll be excited too. What an amazing story that these people in their 70s are putting out a new album. And it seems to be as inspired as the stuff that they were doing in the 70s. What are your thoughts on this?
I'm not a big ABBA fan. I know that they have the song Dancing Queen, but that's probably about it. I can't think of anything else.
Yeah. Okay.
Right now.
Well, somebody stick a link to the YouTube video of I Still Have Faith in You in the comments. I think that would be cool. And Elsie, which I believe is Lovecraft's cat, writes in, what are your thoughts about the upcoming Dune movie by Denis Villeneuve? Well, next week at this very time, I'm going to be talking about Dune with Morgoth on this stream. And by then, it will actually be out. Now, I have actually seen it, though, before the official release date. And I'll say a couple things about it, but you'll have to come next week to hear Morgoth and me discussing it in detail. I think it's only the first, it's one of two films. So basically, it's the whole book, pretty much, being told in form of two films that are going to be each more than 2 hours long. It's more faithful to the story, to the actual twists and turns of the Frank Herbert novel. It's technically extremely well done, but in every scene that you can compare side by side with a similar scene in the David Lynch Dune movie, there's just no comparison. The Lynch movie is so much more artful, even with all of its weirdness and weird process shots and odd stuff that he added in that's not canonical, that's not in the book. The Lynch movie, I think, is far more artful, but this is far more faithful. Denis Villeneuve is a talented director in a technical sense, but what he's shown by taking up movies that have already been done by others. And I'm thinking of his Blade Runner sequel and then Dune, which has been made twice already, is he shows that he's not all that imaginative. And I think that's bad. I didn't see that in his earlier films like Arrival or Sicario, I think it's the name, which I thought were really well done. But when he's working on something there where there's a comparison, either the original Blade Runner movie or Lynch's Dune, he really comes up wanting. It kind of comes up flat to me, flat and unimaginative. And I think he should stop doing this. I think he should stop doing franchises that or remakes and things like that that have already been done, and that he needs to go back to things that are just entirely original. Because I think that he comes off better when he does movies that are just entirely original. Do you have any thoughts about this upcoming film?
I don't.
Are you going to boycott it?
Unfortunately, I haven't actually read the book, so shame on me for that. I know that's a huge fault on my part, but I think I'll probably have to do that before I can say anything on the film.
Okay, great. Well, we have been doing this for 2 hours, and I think it's been really, really a good conversation. So thank you so much for coming on. How do people follow your work?
Well, you can still find me on YouTube for the time being, but they banned my recent videos. So definitely follow me on Odyssey, and then follow me on Telegram as well. That's where I post all my stuff. You can find anything I make on Odyssey and on Telegram. I'm still on Twitter and YouTube for the time being, but you know, that's probably it for a short period of time. So alternative tech is the way to go.
Well, the crawler across the bottom of the screen has Endeavor's Telegram channel. So copy that down, folks, and follow him there. He does fantastic work, and he's a serious commentator. He does serious, high-quality intellectual work, just like Morgoth does, just like American Krogan does. I'm going to get American Krogan on here again soon. We were chatting just recently. It's been too long, so I'm glad we could do this. Tomorrow, Nick Gilvey will have Thomas Steuben and a surprise guest on the Writer's Block, which is on the same channel. It'll start an hour later than this stream, so it starts at 1 o'clock Pacific, 4 o'clock Eastern time. And so it'll be Steuben and a surprise guest, who's also a Countercurrents writer, and Nick Gilvey, and they're going to be talking about the Groiper Civil Wars. They're going to be talking about white identity politics, current events, popular culture, and stuff like that as well. And of course, your questions. So tune in tomorrow at that. And I will be back next week with Morgoth with another episode of Countercurrents Radio.